Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So last week, we discussed the chapter 1 of Canto 9. King Sujumna becomes a woman. So, in the Bhagavad Gita, of course, we read the verse. Is that Vasamsi Janani Tavihaya? That as a person accepts, takes off the old garments, exchanging new garments, so similarly, the soul accepts new bodies. Usually, that happens in the course of we change our body in the next lifetime, although we're also changing our body in this life, from boyhood to childhood to youth to old age. And you know, the body is designed in such a way that you know, it can be modified. It's like a machine. Like a car. Sometimes they modify them. What do they call that? They pimp it up. Pimp my ride, they say. You heard that expression? In America, people who run a prostitution ring and drugs, they usually have millions and millions of dollars, and they spend lavishly on their car. They're called pimps. Pimp my ride. So that in America, they, you know, it's a big fad. They will take an old sort of a car, usually some sort of a classic, but they turn it into something that looks like, you know, something you can't even believe it's a car. But, you know, just everything is just luxury and polished and, immaculate. So the body's like that. You can actually make some significant modifications even to the same body. There's only so far you can go, though. You know, you can't change a car into, well, actually, you know, sometimes they get the cars and they look like a truck because they have the wheels, literally, you know, some of the wheels is high, you know, about 3 meters high or something, you know, some of the wheels. And there's a little car on top. It's like a little bonnet and a little hat. So, there's only a certain amount you can go. But the person remains the same. The person remains the same. And even when they change the car, you know, you still recognise, oh, that's the old Ford, that's the old Holden, that's the old Chevy, like that. You still recognise, you know, even though it's been done. So you can do that with the material body. It is a machine. And there's a very subtle science to doing that with mantra. And there's also, you can use the modern science with a bit of, you know, bringing out the knife and the scalpel and the forceps and the scalpel. So, we discussed that. So these sciences were basically known to the world. Many, you know, we think it's modern science, but actually it was, they actually could manipulate the material body so much better in previous ages. Nothing is new, actually. Everything that we're doing today, everything, it appears to be something wonderful and new, all being done before. Chewing the tube. So now we're going to hear about the dynasties of the sons of Manu. And basically, in this section of the Bhagavatam, you know, we heard about King Sujumna because, why do we hear about King Sujumna? What led us into that topic? Remember? Because he was the grandson of Vaivasvata Manu. Right? So we've heard about all the Manus so far, six Manus, and the different avatars and the Manus and different major events in those Manus, and now therefore we're hearing about Vaivasvata Manu and therefore Vaivasvata Manu was the father of Ikshvaku, and then from Ikshvaku we had certain sons of which Sujumna was one. Alright, so now we're going to do further the dynasties of the sons of Manu, chapter 2. Sukadeva Goswami said, thereafter, when his son Sujumna had thus gone to the forest to accept the order of Vanaprasht, Vaivasvata Manu, Shraddhadev, desirous of getting more sons, performed severe austerities on the bank of the Jamuna for 100 years. Then, because of his desire for sons, the Manu known as Shraddhadev worshipped the Supreme Lord, the Personality of Godhead, the Lord of the demigods. Then he got 10 sons exactly like himself. Among them all, Ikshvaku was the oldest. Right, so it appears that there was Sujumna, and after them, 10 sons, of which the oldest was Ikshvaku. And as we know, Ikshvaku, in the Bhagavad Gita, describes that Vaivasvata Manu, the sun god, heard the Bhagavad Gita from Krishna about 40 million years ago. And then Ikshvaku received that knowledge from Manu, and then it was passed on. So these personalities, they were all aware of Krishna, you know, they would have been all aware of. Would have heard the Gita even in those days. So, you know, one time, one of Srila Prabhupada's disciples, I think it was a disciple, he mentioned that, I think he was asking a question, but he was saying that the Bhagavad Gita was 5,000 years old. Etc. etc. And Prabhupada says, have you not read the Bhagavad Gita? Because from the Gita we understand he spoke it 5,000 years ago, but it goes way, way back. So a lot of people, even in India, they still think the Bhagavad Gita maybe so many thousand years when Krishna spoke it. Actually, it goes way back. Among these sons, Prishadra following the order of his spiritual master, was engaged as a protector of cows. He would stand all night with a sword to give the cows protection. Purport. One who becomes Virshan takes a vow to stand all night with a sword to give protection to the cows. Because Prishadrap was engaged in this way, it is understood that he had no dynasty. We can further understand from this vow accepted by Prishadra how essential it is to protect the cows. Some son of a Kshatriya would take this vow to protect the cows from ferocious animals even at night. What then is said to be of sending cows to slaughterhouses? This is the most sinful activity in human society. Once at night, while it was raining, a tiger entered the land of the cowshed. Upon seeing the tiger, all the cows who were lying down got up in fear and scattered here and there on the land. When the very strong tiger seized the cow screamed in distress and fear, and Prishadra, hearing the screaming, immediately followed the sound. He took up his sword, but because the stars were covered by clouds, he mistook the cow for the tiger and mistakenly cut off the cow's head with great force. Because the tiger's ear had been cut by the edge of the sword, the tiger was very afraid and it fled from the place while bleeding on the street. In the morning, when Prishadra, who was quite able to subdue his enemy, saw that he had killed the cow, although at night he thought that he had killed the tiger, he was very unhappy. Although Prishadra had committed the sin unknowingly, his family priest Vasistha cursed him, saying, "In your next life, you shall not be able to become a Kshatriya. Instead, you shall take birth as a Sudra because of killing a cow." Purport, it appears that Vasistha was not free from Tamagun, the mode of ignorance. As the family priest or spiritual master of Prishadra, Vasistha should have taken Prishadra's offence very lightly. But instead, Vasistha cursed him to become a Sudra. It is the duty of a family priest not to curse a disciple, but to give him relief through the performance of some sort of atonement. Vasistha, however, did just the opposite. Therefore, Śrīla Viśvanātha Cakravarti the Course says that he was Dumati. In other words, his intelligence was not very good. So, you know, we see this in preaching, that sometimes you know, I've had perhaps a ceremony booked in the morning with someone, and then I have to leave the temple after their ceremony and go to someone's house, where you might have 80 people waiting, and they need to start at a certain muhurta, which has been fixed up to the minute at that. And the people who are going to come in the morning, they've arrived like you know, an hour and a half to 2 hours late. Thinking that, oh, you know, the priest is, they just live there, so, you know, it doesn't really matter. But you can't show, so they really, then the other people become angry at me because I'm going to be 2 hours late. But so what happens is that, you know, I can't show them anger because I'm supposed to be, the whole process is they're supposed to get a blessing. And the people who are waiting for me, who keep calling me, they're angry at me, and I can't show them any anger.
Can you put in like a cancellation force?
Yeah, look, we probably wouldn't have any clients, any customers, you know. because a lot of people don't come, not everyone comes here because they're attached to Krishna. You know, they come here because it may, you know, practically be the better option. They're going to get some nice prasad, and they don't get it in another temple. And, you know, not everyone has to pay for the prasad, and, you know, like that. So, you know, if you cause a little disturbance, they just go to the Hindu temple or somewhere, and they never come back. Even though they've done something that they shouldn't. So that's a big cost for them, that instead of, that's their one chance in this lifetime to properly get attached to Krishna. And if you show them anger or displeasure, they may never come back. So that's too much. That's too much. Even though it's it. So, but you know, I have seen over the course of time where people do become, you know, devotees do become irate at the people we're supposed to be preaching to. You know, sometimes it's required, you know, if someone's offending devotees, they have to be stopped and put in their place, or if they're, you know, threatening or this, that or the other. You know, in some cases it may be required. But generally we have to be... you see, even Prabhupada quite often quote about Lord Jesus that even though they were going to crucify him, he asked, you know, God, Krishna, to forgive them for their ignorance. They don't know what they're doing. They're in ignorance. Of course they're going to do something like that. They're ignorant. Yeah. And of course we see, you know, Lord Nityananda, you know, who's smashed over the head with a clay pot. And he also, you know, begged Lord Chaitanya, don't kill them, give them shelter mercy. So, you know, these are the examples. So we do have to be... So here you see Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core. You know, he's pointing out that, you know, this may be some of the sages and sadhus, the yogis, you know, in their line they may do that, but as far as Vaishnavas are concerned, we should be more intelligent and compassionate. And but not just with guests, but also, you know, with you know, the way a senior devotee, you know, treats other devotees who may be, you know, somewhat under their shelter for a little guidance or something in one way or another. Even then also one has to be you know, very tolerant and compassionate. But of course, you know, what Prisida did was very serious, and he cut the head off a cow, and his job was to protect them. So that's very serious. That's like, you know, almost like murdering someone. It was almost, you know, killing someone. So it's a big event. Still, it wasn't, you know, it was accidental. It was night, he couldn't see, he was trying to protect, the intention was to protect, and a very dangerous situation. And that all should have been taken into consideration. So that's a big thing for him to, so, you know, as it says, you know, it appears that to guard them every night meant that he wasn't going to have a family, expand a family, to do that service. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to do it. So that's a big sacrifice. And then for him to have to take birth as a Shudra, So if we want to please the Acharyas, Śrīla Viṣvanātha Chakrabarti Thakura, Chaitanya Mahāprabhu, we have to be careful.
So, Prabhu, in your example, how do you deal with such a situation?
That someone has done something.
Yeah, I mean, we are late for the second person's appointment.
Yeah.
It affects both of them, so how do you...
How do I deal with it?
Yeah.
What I consider is that, my service to Krishna is that when these people associate with me, that they will be, at the end of that, they'll be very happy with both the devotee and Krishna. So then, if when I go to those people and I can be 2 hours late because someone has made me 2 hours late, my intention is that everything I do will be so pleasing that what they become angry at me, they will feel, we should never be here. This is so wonderful. Everything is so wonderful that has no. So I go out of my way to make sure that by the time I leave, they're completely satisfied. By the way, by the way I personally deal with them, and I usually, of course, anything a devotee does, we do because Krishna is the ability of man. So then I, understanding this is a very serious situation. I'm praying to Krishna. Somehow or another, Krishna, something has to happen that's just a little mystical. something that they feel for me, if they feel Krishna's presence, it covers everything. So, my intention is that when I, with those people, they will feel the presence of Krishna, something mystical. Hello? Yes, speaking. Yeah. Okay, yeah. That's fine, Yeah, okay, thanks for calling. Thank you very much. And what I find is that something does happen. So some of the things I've seen is that I went to one place, like this had actually happened, I was late because of someone else. They were angry at me, they kept calling, when they're really angry, they call you every 3 minutes. Well, how far are you now? I got that boy. So I got there, and they had a child who was a really naughty child that I had to do a mundan for. And this is, I could see that none of the parents, or the grandparents, or anyone could control this child. And I'm looking at that, and I'm thinking, Krishna, if that child sits quietly for me, while I do his haircut and enjoys it, our job will be done. Right? And I've watched this child, I've done, and through the whole ceremony, do the fire jug and everything. They have to take him out of the house. He's crying. He's this, that, and the other. So many things. And then, when I sit down, when I do the hair cutting, he's quiet as a mouse. Nothing, not a tear. Sits there happily, peaceful. And they're all like... And that is the most important thing to them. The fact that the child peacefully sat there and didn't become traumatized during the hair cutting, then everything is forgiven. And I've seen that. I could go in there all proud. You shouldn't, you know, get angry at a brahmana and, you know, and this and that. I could go in like that. That would only make it worse. So, you know, we do have to... Yeah, I think last week, was it last week, we read that verse from the Gita. Just have to have mine here. And, you know, we've been discussing these essential verses from the Bhagavad Gita, and... So it says that chapter 4, verse 22. These are the symptoms of someone who's come to the position of transcendental knowledge. So chapter 4, verse 22 of the Bhagavad Gita. Yadrichala vasantushto dvandvitito vimatsaraha samasiddha vasiddhocha kitvapina nibhajyate. He who is satisfied with gain which comes of its own accord, who is free from duality, does not envy. So although someone's angry at us like Jesus, they're going to crucify him. He's not envious of them. He's still their well-wisher. Who is steady in both success and failure. You know, things are going drastically wrong. No matter what you do to make them right, they're going drastically wrong. They're steady. You know, you're working with Krishna. Although performing action is never entangled, although performing actions. See, the work of a man who is unattached to the next verse. Gata sangasya muktasya jnanavasita chetasya jagya charatara kamma sangraham pravaliyate. Now this jagya, you know, working, that all your actions are done for the sake of jagya, they're done for the sake of Vishnu or Krishna. And in the purport it says there that, it says, consequently, whatever he does for Krishna, who is the primeval Vishnu. Therefore, all his works are technically sacrifices because sacrifice involves satisfying the Supreme Person, Krishna. Right? So, when we're doing things jagyate for the sake of jagya, or krishnate for the sake of Krishna, and we're unattached to the modes. So, something is making you angry. That's the influence of tamagun. But we're not attached to getting any satisfaction from tamagun through anger. We're attached to Krishna's satisfaction. So we keep ourselves detached from the modes. Only what is going to satisfy Krishna, then everything comes to the spiritual platform. And basically... where we remain attached to the modes of nature, satisfying our own ambitions or anger or frustration of ambitions as a devotee, at that point, that restricts the service that we do. Because we can either serve the most, we can either serve Maya or we can serve Krishna. We're either in the darkness or in the sunshine, like that. But when we don't attach ourselves to any happiness in the modes of material nature, then we're on the purely spiritual path. So there, you know, therefore, Vishwanath Chakrabarti, the core, is pointing that out. So our dealings with Vaishnavas should be on the spiritual platform. So an interesting change in what I perceive in ISKCON now that it's got bigger. Previously, if you came to ISKCON, you didn't come for a social life. There was no social life, you know. If you came to ISKCON, you were going to work hard day and night. You didn't have time, you know, for anything. Now, you can actually come to ISKCON and just socialise. You know, go to the Sunday feast, go to the festivals, you know, join a little family group like that. A little service here and there, like that. So, many times when devotees associate with other devotees, it's not necessarily, you know, they say, people think, oh, I'm associating with devotees, but their association can quite often be very little Shravana, Kirtana, Vishnu, hearing, chanting, and or based upon, you know, some service and preaching. You know, that's there to some degree, but then there can be 50, 70, 90% of just the general social interactions. Not that we're against social interactions, but it's not necessarily being done, you know, for Krishna's pleasure, but more so just in the general way that people are satisfying their own, you know, what is that, you know, society, friendship and love. Right? People, we're attracted to society, friendship and love in this world. And sometimes devotees, they are associated with devotees, but not so much with the Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, but more literally just enjoying the society, friendship and love aspect. And quite often that can be very much tainted with the modes of material nature. And then they're wondering that I'm doing so much association but not making progress. Why is that? And that's why. But if we associate with devotees who are spiritually situated, Krishna is firmly the centre, not society, friendship and love, then one makes very rapid progress. One feels the presence of Krishna very strongly, and one learns how to feel the presence of Krishna in their own life very quickly. That's the difference. And therefore, you do see that when there are some influences of the modes of material nature, then that sort of association with devotees very quickly can lead to strained, stressful interactions. Because whenever the modes of material nature is there, it causes quarrel, disturbance. The more it remains on the spiritual platform, the less likelihood there is of that relationship strain. So when the hero Prisadra was thus cursed by his spiritual master, he accepted the curse with folded hands. Then, having controlled his senses, he took the vow of a brahmachari, which is approved by all great sages. Thereafter, Prisadra gained relief from all responsibilities, became peaceful in mind, and established control over all of his senses. Being unaffected by the material conditions, being pleased with whatever was available by the grace of the Lord to maintain body and soul together, and being equal toward everyone. So that was mentioned in that previous verse in Bhagavad Gita 4:21. He gave full attention to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vasudeva, who is thus transcendental, the transcendental super soul, free from all material contamination. Thus, Prisadra, fully satisfied in pure knowledge, always keeping his mind on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, achieved pure devotional service to the Lord and began travelling all over the world without affection for material activities, as if he were deaf, dumb and blind. So, same thing being repeated here. Those verses of the Gita that they're interesting. See, in verse 19 of that fourth chapter of the Gita says, Ishasave samarambha kama sankalpa vajata gyanagni dagde kamanam tambahu panditam buddha. One who is understood to be in full knowledge, whose every act is devoid of desire for sense gratification, he is said to be by sages to be a worker whose fruit of action is burned up by the fire of perfect knowledge. So then those following verses. Acting for the bare necessities of life, satisfied with gain that comes of its own accord, etc., etc. We ask, how do we know someone is situated in perfect knowledge? These are the qualities. And sometimes, people do the bhakti shasti, etc., etc. And they come out and they can rattle off 100 slokas. Very scholarly. But they're not necessarily situated in perfect knowledge, like this realization, because that is demonstrated by these qualities. So they can, they appear to be very knowledgeable. Some people just have a really good memory. They can memorize so many sections of the Gita and Bhagavatam. This appears like they have so much knowledge, but it's memory. But as soon as there's some disturbance, then they're not acting for Krishna's sake, they're actually acting, because of some disturbance. What Krishna wants in the situation doesn't matter anymore. Now they're just going to react to something that's disturbing. That's a different thing. So that's not what's called perfect knowledge. So You know, when someone has done Bhakti Shastri, all these qualities, that's what you want to see then. You know, you study Bhakti Bhagavad Gita. Okay, then even in happiness and distress, failure, you know, success or failure, a person never wavers from the point, my reaction to these circumstances or this person will be based upon what's pleasing to Krishna, not according to how I react according to the different modes of material nature that I'm contaminated with. That's the sign of perfect knowledge. That's the person who's actually Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhava, Bhakti Vedanta. It's not just scholarship. You know, therefore, you know, Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. Vyasadeva is known as a great scholar of the Vedas, he wrote it. But he spoke to Arjuna. Arjuna had to go through... He was tested to the limit as to whether he would react for him to what concerned himself, or he would put all that aside and react to what Krishna wanted. And Arjuna's character of devotional service was such that under such circumstances, he lost his son, so many people had to be killed. He put all of that aside, and he was only going to act according to Krishna's consideration. Therefore, he is the scholar, the knower of Gita. But we don't know. We don't look at Arjuna, you know, as the knower of the Gita because he's done the, you know, some commentary on the, you know, the verses of the Gita and analyzed all the Sanskrit, and he can. You know, so we don't look at Arjuna like that. We look at him as a man of perfect knowledge, fully realizing the Gita, because of these, you know, he showed the symptoms of a person who's unattached to the modes of material nature and acts fully according to Krishna consciousness. And, you know, actually, that's one of the things which, although we're doing the courses, so that's a start. You know, we have our prerequisites. You know, one has to be chanting Hare Krishna and doing some regular service and so many things. And then they get the certificate and what have you. But you know, it's not a full, clear representation of who actually has properly understood Gita. So we come back to this verse in text number 14 that with this attitude, Prisadra became a great saint, and when he entered the forest and saw a blazing forest fire, he took this opportunity to burn his body in the fire. Thus he achieved the transcendental spiritual world. So we quote, Prabhupada quotes Bhagavad Gita 4.9. So of course, from understanding the Bhagavad Gita, one who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not, upon leaving the body, take his birth again in this material world, but attains my eternal abode, O Arjuna. One who understands Krishna means that they understand how to act to please Krishna. That person does not. Therefore, it says, Ivam yoveti tatvataha, in truth. To know Krishna in truth. to know the Gita, Krishna's, to know Krishna means to know Krishna's teachings in truth. To know Krishna in truth means how to follow his teachings, means how to act only for always thinking of Krishna's interest and never for one's own interest. That's knowing Krishna in truth. That's the knower of the Gita. The knower of the Gita is the knower of Krishna. That person can return home back to Godhead. Not someone who's a scholar of the Gita, and as soon as something disturbs their own, you know, subtle or gross material ambitions, that they react in a way which is which would be disturbing to Krishna. It would be harmful to the preaching, or, you know, disillusioning for devotees, or whatever. Therefore, that verse, Bahu Jama Kariya Shavari Kirtanam, even if one chants the holy name for many, many lifetimes, they will not get the love of Godhead if there are offences. So, now, Prisadra, because of his karma, was cursed to take his next birth as a Sudra, but because he took the saintly life, especially concentrating his mind always upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he became a pure devotee. Immediately after giving up his body in the fire, he reached the spiritual world, as mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, Mameti, as a result of his devotional situation. Devotional service performed by thinking of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is so powerful that although Prisadra was cursed, he avoided the terrible consequences of becoming a Sudra and instead returned home back to Godhead. Prabhupada quotes this verse from Brahma Samhita 554. Those who engage in devotional service are unaffected by the results of their material activities. Otherwise, everyone from the smallest microbe up to the King of Heaven, Indra, is subject to the laws of karma. A pure devotee, being always engaged in the service of the Lord, is exempt from these laws. So much so that he was also exempt from the curse of Vasistha. It took place, so even if Krishna decides that he doesn't want to undo, you know, the spoken word, the intention of a brahmana, still keeping that intact, the devotee still becomes completely immune, in fact benefits from even such a curse, without removing the curse or revoking it. So, you know, sometimes you see that I have had devotees come to me that they feel that some relatives are cursing them. There's a lot of that. A lot of that goes on, you know, from India, you know, they're doing the black magic tantric. And, but, without to understand, is that even if that, you know, those black arts are being performed, and even it takes effect in one's life, for a devotee, Krishna is so clever that he will turn that the devotee benefits from that and is in a better situation for fulfilling their devotional aspirations. And therefore, you know, see, we don't chant the holy name of the Lord for material purposes. It's an offence to consider the glories of chanting the holy name of the Lord to be one of the auspicious ritualistic activities often devoted to fruitful activities, karma kanda. So we don't chant the holy name of the Lord or perform ceremonies or worship Krishna so much for some, you know, like a karma kanda, you know, treating, trying to get some material result, you know, that so much. But if people ask us to to chant on their behalf, to pray on their behalf, or do ceremonies on their behalf, then we pray and we, you know, we can tell them that, yes, you've got this problem like that, yes, I'll pray for you. But you're not necessarily using the holy name for some material benefit that they need fixed. You say I pray that you become nicely situated in your relationship with Krishna, that all the obstacles on that path become removed, because by so doing, then Krishna will adjust everything. So, again, you know, therefore, sometimes, again, you know, devotees, if someone has some material problem, sometimes the devotees are hesitant to pray for them or, you know, do some worship of the Lord on their behalf or something. They shouldn't do anything which, in one sense, is, say, disturbing Krishna for some temporary material benefits. But we take the same situation and we literally do something in such a way that we help that person advance when we do some prayer or ceremony or worship, so they learn from us and it changes their consciousness. And then we also pray for them to, you know, advance further in that consciousness. And that fixes, that actually fixes the result of the material thing that they want fixed. Oh, someone's cursing me, my child is sick, this one and that one. Without doing something for some material benefit for Krishna based upon this. Well, he didn't light the fire. He didn't take a box of matches with him. But the fire, as it says here, that and when he entered the forest and saw a blazing fire, he took the opportunity to burn his body in the fire. So
he's working on his own work. He wanted to end this and he...
No, well, it's saying that his desire is to worship the Lord so that he can eternally serve the Lord and go back to Godhead. Then this blazing fire happens along. And he sees this as literally Krishna's arrangement to just quickly finish up everything and, you know, go back to Godhead. So for instance, it'd be something like, say sometimes devotees get cancer and they find out about it when it's in, you know, the terminal stage. Nothing they can do. I think Gandharvika was a bit like that, Gandharvika. And she decided, no medicine. I want to go back to Godhead. I'll go. I'm not going to fight this illness. It's like a fire burning up your body, cancer. You know, you're not going to try and prolong her life or run. Or, no. I want to go back to Godhead. Krishna's ready to take me right now. I'm ready to go. I said, no medicine, I'm going. It's like that. It's sort of unavoidable, you know. It's in his situation, he's in the middle of a forest fire. You know, it's almost unavoidable. Sometimes people, what amazes me, you know, you see pictures of people. There's a tsunami coming. Right? The tsunami's about 10 feet away from them, and they've just realised that this is going to kill them. So they turn around and run. Right? I mean, you know, what's that? There's another 2 seconds away before the wave hits. And they run in panic. Ah! You know. What is it going to do? You know, better say, you know, for a devotee, okay, Krishna's come to take me. I've got 2 seconds. Hare Krishna, gone. So it's more like that. Yeah, so he evidently understood. He sort of offered his panache, right? I'm done. I'm in a fire. I'm in a room. There's no escape. Burned down. I've got 1 or 2 seconds of life. Of my obeisance as a Christian, I'm going. So it's like that. What's that? He grabbed a hot Nityananda. Is that the deity? So, Ayendra, yeah. What happened? The deity, his deity. He held the deity's feet.
The deities were made of timber
as well. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh really?
Yeah.
Right, because he held on so tight. Yeah. So it's like that. It's like that. But you know, it's good to ask those questions because we don't want people committing suicide. You know. There's a lot of unstable people who come to Krishna consciousness. And literally they'll read something like this and think, oh, that's what devotees do. You know. We don't want them plucking their eyes out like Viva Mangala at the core. We don't want them, you know, starting a fire in the forest and burning themselves up. So it's good to ask those questions and clarify that devotees are not looking to kill themselves.
But in the case of Prithu Maharaj, he generated internally a yogic fire which burnt his body.
Mm.
And in the purpose of Prabhupada, of course, that was Krishna Tudiya Parabhankaja Pandalanda. In other words, that a devotee prays that take me now when I am healthy enough to remember you and chant your name, rather than I'm old and, you know, there's mucus and bile and I'm not even able to chant your name. So how do we understand that?
So, yeah, a devotee does pray like that. So, who is that? That was
Prithu
Maharaj.
I think it's from
Mukunda
Manas
Stotra,
from by King
Kulashi. Yeah, King Kulashi, etc. Yeah. Do you have that verse here?
I can
pull it. Yeah, if you pull up that verse. as well. Shweta's, you have that?
So I think it is a mode of taking off one life, but not for that I'm suffering, but rather to do devotion self that I want to be with you.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that verse, but I mean, do you have that verse about King Preeti Maharaj?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'll take it
up. And I'll just read a couple of these verses while you get that one, if you can find that. That'd be good. Being reluctant to accept material enjoyment, Manu's youngest son, whose name was Kavi, gave up the kingdom before attaining full youth. Accompanied by his friends, he went to the forest, always thinking of the self-effulgent Supreme Personality of Godhead within the core of his heart. Thus he attained perfection. From Karusha, another son of Manu, came the Karusha dynasty, a family of Kshatriyas. The Karushas, Kshatriyas, were the kings of the northern direction. They were celebrated protectors of Brahminical culture and were all firmly religious. From the son of Manu named Drishta came a Kshatriya caste called Dashta, whose members achieved the position of Brahmanas in this world. Then from the son of Manu named Nriga came Sumati. From Sumati came Bhuta Jyoti, and from Bhuta Jyoti came Vasu. Now, in this purport, it describes that here it is said, although the Dharishtas belonged to the Kshatriya caste, they were able to convert themselves into Brahmanas. This gives clear evidence supporting the following statement by Narada Muni in 7.11.35. If the qualities of one group are found in the men of another, those men should be recognized by their qualities, by their symptoms, not by the caste of the family in which they were born. Birth is not at all important. It is one's qualities that are stressed in all Vedic literature. So that applies on the material platform and on the spiritual platform, as we were discussing. It's the qualities. Now, this verse, 4.23.13 of Preeti Maharaj, going back to Godhead. In due course of time, when Preeti Maharaj was to give up his body, he fixed his mind firmly upon the lotus feet of Krishna, and thus completely situated on the Brahma Bhuta platform, he gave up the material body. All right. Now, says Preeti Maharaj, by the grace of Krishna, could understand that the end of his life was near, and thus he became very jubilant and proceeded to completely give up his body on the Brahma Bhuta stage by practicing the yogic process. Right. It is thoroughly described in the following verses how one can voluntarily give up this body and return home back to Godhead. Now, the yogic process practiced by Preeti Maharaj at the time of death accelerates the giving up of this body while one is in sound health physically and mentally. Every devotee desires to give up the body while it is sound physically and mentally. This desire was also expressed by King Kulikshetra. So, as it describes here, since it is very difficult to vibrate any sound while choking, it is simply by Krishna's grace that one can chant Hare Krishna at the time of death. However, by situating oneself in the Muktasana position, a yogi can immediately give up his body and go to whatever planet he desires. A perfect yogi can give up his body whenever he desires through the practice of yoga. So, now, a yogi may give up his body and go to another planet in a subtle body, as we describe, and that sort of shows again what we're discussing about the moon, that they leave the gross body here and they go there in a more subtle body, which again proves that, you know, they exist in subtle features. That's a suitable body for the upper planetary system. And so that's a yogi. Now, a devotee, they tend to give up their body at the time, not necessarily, when Krishna is willing, when Krishna wants. So you see, when Prabhupada was leaving his body, they wanted Prabhupada to stay. Prabhupada was saying, Krishna willing, if he wants me to stay, if he wants me to go, it's up to Krishna, I doubt. That's the devotee's move. Now, here, Prithi Maharaj, it says, by the grace of Krishna, could understand that the end of his life was near. So actually, death was there. But the only thing he was going to... Death was already there. He understood, our time is up. Your death is coming. But he just adjusted that okay, time is up, then at the best situation I can be in, so I can think of Krishna, I will use the yogic process to leave this body in Krishna consciousness. But again, death was already there, like the blazing fire, like the cancer, Krishna had indicated to him, death is here. Bhaktivinoda Thakur's grandfather, who was also a great yogi, he understood astrologically that death will be here at this point. And so he also went into a yogic trance and he asked Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you come and you be present when I leave my body. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I think it was a young child, watched and saw his grandfather leave his body in a yogic position. But he also understood astrologically, death is there. I'm hoping I can also do that. When it gets a little hard to judge, but if I get to that point, I think, oh yeah, okay, any day now. So then, try and use up the best of my time to, okay, and, some deep breathing, relax. So it's actually the same principle. He wasn't chasing death, it was indicated that death was there. But a yogi, other yogis, they give up their body, but they don't necessarily die because they go to another planet. But most yogis, are able to somehow or another predict their death to a certain degree. A lot of yogis, they can understand, and they use the yogic process, not necessarily to, because the whole yogic process extends the duration of life. That's why they practice in yoga. So they're not seeking for a quick death. They're usually trying to extend their life. So, but when they're aware that, okay, now this is the time, which they have their ways and means of doing that, then they can just accelerate that at that time. So that's a slightly different thing. Okay. So once again, we are not encouraging anyone, nor are our books encouraging anyone to accelerate their death. Because as if that's a fast way back to Krishna, because that's not. And we see in the pastimes of Sanatana Goswami that he wanted to commit suicide, go back to the spiritual world, because he was so grief-stricken with separation from Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But he went to Vrindavan. I think he was going to jump off Govardhan Hill and kill himself. And they told him, you can't do that. You can't destroy that body. That body doesn't belong to you. It belongs to Krishna. How can you destroy that body? That's Krishna's body. So a devotee thinks like that. I can't just start my own fire and destroy the body. This is not my property. To, you know. So, and therefore he understood, from there, that yes, I have some business to do for Krishna, and they pointed out what that business was. You've associated with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. You have so much knowledge. We need to put this into writing and you know, for the benefit of the whole world. So they understood. I can't commit suicide because the body is not mine. Krishna has some. As long as Krishna wants me to work with his body for some purpose, I have no right to accelerate death. But if Krishna says now is the time to die, within that one or two days we may accelerate death in the sense that let me somehow take the opportunity to leave the body while I'm thinking of Krishna. That's a slightly different thing.
Then that's the same principle. I've heard that some devotees, when they know that death is going to come, they just fast. They stop eating.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. You're accelerating death. That's like I was talking about Gandharvika. She got the cancer. And literally by not taking medication, you accelerate death. It will come quicker. But you'll be clearer in your consciousness. Because, you know, having doctors drag you from one, you know, operating theatre to another, cutting off this, cutting off that, you know, putting so many drugs and medicines and things, very disturbing. Very disturbing. I think one of Prabhupada's requests, don't let them drag me off to hospital, you know. Very disturbing to have to go to that. When you're trying to think of Krishna, or the speaker being in the room of so many other people, you know, the relatives come in, you're there in the bed next door, you're trying to think of Krishna. You know, oh, it was a great game of footy on the weekend, wasn't it, you know? Oh, yeah, the kangaroos got up, that, you know, kicked that. You're trying to think of good. So, you know, you want to be in a place and you know, a situation where you can think of Krishna. So that's acceptable. That's acceptable. But it's a different thing. Death is already there. The son of Vasu was Pratika, whose son was Ogavan. Ogavan's son was also known as Ogavan. And his daughter was Ogavati. It would have figured. Sudarshan married that daughter. From Nidishanta came a son named Chitrasen, and from him a son named Riksha. From Riksha came Midvan, from Midvan came Purna, and from Purna came Indrasena. From Indrasena came Vitihotra, from Vitihotra came Satyasrava, from Satyasrava came the son named Urushrava, and from Urushrava came Devadatta. From Devadatta came a son known as Agnivesha, who was the fire god himself. This son, who was a celebrated saint, was well known as Kanina and Jatukanya. It's not unusual that some of the various different sun gods are taking birth in this family. And we're just reading that in Srimad Bhagavatam as well, that three sons of they're reading the story of it was Prithi Maharaj, goes back to Godhead, might have been some of his sons, Prithi Maharaj, some of the sons of Prithi Maharaj, fire gods as well. That they'd also been cursed. I think it was also by the system. It does a bit of cursing. And they were fire gods. They took birth in the family of Prithi Maharaj, and then they followed the yogi process. And by that yogi process, they were able to elevate themselves back to the heavenly planets as the fire gods again. So the various types of one of the children asked an intelligent question, you know, in the class that. You know, I thought there was just one fire god, he said. How come there's three? And if they're here, then where's the fire god in heaven? So actually, there's a principal fire god, but there, like Shiva, there are many Rudras, many different forms, expansions of Shiva, the Rudras, many. And so the fire god's like that as well. So when we do a fire jagya, sometimes people want to do two for the price of one. So they say, you know, the child is 6 months old, let's give them the first grains, and maybe while we're here we'll do the hair cutting as well. So basically what you do is you worship the particular form of the fire god who accepts the worship and the offerings, and the offerings, they accept the offerings and they pass them to the Lord, who is the enjoyer of the offerings. But they pass them to the Lord in a purified state, as far as purifying. And then, after that, then with the same fire going, you, by mantra, ask another different fire god that you please enter, and you worship him, and then perform the ceremony for that, you know, hair cutting like that. So there are different types of agnis who accept different types of, you know, so they enter the fire, that demigod. And, you know, they are responsible for that, accepting the offerings for that particular type of jagya. Mm. No.
And that he was, for any yagya, that fire god was
allowed? No. So
different types of fire.
Different types of agni, different persons. And the same that, you know, different types of Shivas, different types of Rudras. And if you get to know them, they all have a slightly different function, although very similar in one sense. Very similar to Shiva, but slightly different. So, O king from Agnivesha came a Brahminical dynasty known as Agnivesha-yan. Now that I've described the descendants of Narishyanta, let me describe the descendants of Dishta. Please hear from me. In fact, you know, at the beginning of a jagya, you light a fire and then you purify that fire and you throw it to the south, I think it is. And then you know, so there is that particular form is inauspicious, a particular agni, you cast it away, and then you perform the jagya with from there on with the, so, you know, there, yeah. So, you know, we were talking about people going to the moon, that, you know, we can't even see the subtle demigods that we're interacting with. You know, we're interacting with Agni whenever we do a jagya. There are varieties of them, and we think there's just one. Even we have some sense that they're there. We have, even on this planet, we have no idea, except for Shastra, we can't even see. And they're going to they want to go to the higher planets, and they think that they're going to see. They can't even see what's going on here. Even we're trained in knowledge and reading the Shastra, we have difficulty understanding. And they think that just by getting in a rocket, they're going to go there, and they're looking around, oh, we can't see anything, it's just dust here. So now he's described the descendants of Nadishyanti. Now he's going to describe the descendants of Dishta. Dishta had a son by the name Nabaga. Now, let's see. Oh, yeah. See, in the books, do you have this? I mean, you know, there's actually all of these persons. There's a nice family tree. You have that in your book? Do you have that? It's not on the phone, right? No. No, there we go.
Even in hard copy, I've got the small volume. It's not in the small.
They don't even put it. They're leaving things out. It's only one page. Yeah, you know, I know when we were doing the fifth canto, it appeared that some of the pictures, you know, in the newer books were different to the older books, so less. I mean, it's only one page, you know, how much money are they going to save? But it's all there. Very easy, like, When you read all this, you know, if you look at the picture, it's so easy to follow where everyone is and like that, you know. So easy. This Nabaga, who is different from the Nabaga described later, became a Vaishya by occupational duty. The son of Nabaga was known as Balandana. The son of Balandana was Vatsapriti, and his son was Pramshu. Pramshu's son was Pramati. Pramati's son was Kanitra. Kanitra's son was Chakshusha, and his son was Vivimshati. So, purport. From Manu, one son became a Kshatriya, another Brahmin, another a Vaishya. This confirms the statement by Narada Muni. 7.11.35. One should always remember that Brahmins, Kshatriyas and Vaishyas should never be regarded as members of a caste by birth. A Brahmana may be changed into a Kshatriya. A Kshatriya into a Brahmana. Similarly, a Brahmana or Kshatriya may be changed into a Vaishya, and a Vaishya into a Brahmana or Kshatriya. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita. Chatur Vanyam Mayashristam Gunakama Vabhagasha. So one is a Brahmana, Kshatriya, or Vaishya, never by birth but by quality. There is a great need of Brahmanas. Therefore, in the Krishna consciousness movement, we are trying to train some brahmanas to guide human society. Because at present there is a scarcity of brahmanas, the brain of human society is lost. Because practically everyone is a sudra. No one at the present moment can guide the members of society to the proper path by which to achieve perfection in life. And now here we're having these shastric evidences of this principle, but you know, in India, where the home of the where Krishna spoke about the Varnashram system, hardly a person you speak to will understand this point, that it's not by birth. In fact, one of the reasons why India is, you know, throwing out the Varnashram, or what they call the caste system, is because they don't like the system, because they think it's based on by birth, and they don't like that. They think that they don't like that, but they're throwing out. They should throw out that system based on birth and put in the actual system, but they don't know that there is an actual system based on quality and work. They don't know that that's the proper system, that's the original system. And why don't they know? Because it's in the Bhagavad Gita, which they never read. Or they've changed it or something. What's that? They've misused it.
Like,
yeah.
As a kid, we used to read a story that there was a king, and when he was riding a horse, one person had stopped him and said, he said something like, I have an emergency that I have to go. I don't remember the emergency right now. And he asked the king, can you please give me a ride? And the king got down, and then he immediately jumped on the horse and started driving. The king just said, don't tell this to anybody. Because then another person will not do this favor. If a person is really in need,
yeah,
he will miss out. So okay, you've done it, but don't tell this. But basically is the caste system.
If they're a low class birth, they're a low class person. Don't do them any favours.
The Brahmins have actually misused the caste system.
Yeah.
And then to correct it now, they've gone the other way around.
Yeah.
Bending backwards. And they say that, okay, these people have suffered, and so we have to give them an opportunity. The Brahmins, they misused it. They should have been legal.
Yeah.
They have misused it.
Mm. And you know, Gandhi...
The caste system of Agni.
Yeah, abandoning. And see, Gandhi, he tried to rubber stamp them as Mahajan. What's that? Harijan. Mm-hmm. We call them the children of Hari, God's children, Harijan. Just rubber stamped. But you can't just rubber stamp someone. They actually have, you have to, to be Harijan, one has to be, guided how to worship Hari. And as we read in the Bhagavad Gita, Harijan means that they accept that which comes of its own accord. See, you see these verses. Now, Krishna has described that there are four classes of persons: Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, or Sudras. But any of them, whether a Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Sudra, if they follow these verses, if they have the qualities, by knowledge. They're trained in knowledge, and that knowledge, they act on that knowledge, means, is in verses 20, 21, 22, that, you know, for instance, in 22, let's see, 21, such a man acts with mind and intelligence perfectly controlled, gives up all sense of proprietorship over his possessions and acts only for the bare necessities of life. Thus working is not affected by sinful reactions. That's Harijan. And it doesn't matter if they're born as a sudra. This verse is not just for sannyasis or chatriyas. It doesn't matter whether you know, whatever your birth is, even if you're chandala. Therefore we see that Prishada, he took birth as a sudra, but he was Harijan. So Bhagavad Gita is teaching that you don't have to rubber stamp someone Harijan. That won't do if they still behave like sudras. Or rubber stamp someone a brahmana because they got the Brahman thread. But they actually become elevated no matter what their birth is, if they develop these qualities. He who is satisfied which gains which comes of its own accord, free from duality, does not envy, steady in both success and failure, is never entangled although performing actions. The man of a work who is unattached to the material modes of nature and who is fully situated in transcendental knowledge merges entirely into transcendence. See? So Srila Prabhupada, he's creating from the class of sudras and less, he's giving them transcendental knowledge from Gita, the perfect knowledge, teaching them how to act on that transcendental platform, not according to the modes of material nature. They're Harijan. They become guru. And we see here that, you know, in several verses, that materially you can change a person's from a brahmana to a kshatriya to vaishya if they develop those qualities and work in that way, and spiritually you can change a person's qualities if they work in that way as Harijan, Vishnujan. Rajavasi. You know, you can become like a resident of the spiritual world if you're always immersed in the pastimes of Radha Krishna. So these are Shastric evidences. Now, then verse 25, the son of, you know, so what, of course, what we can take from this and what we did take from it, because, you know, when I became a devotee in 1978, I distinctly remember that from the Hindu community, they really didn't think, they thought that, you know, we just weren't qualified to ever do anything Hindu as a brahmana, a kshatriya, a vaishya, or anything. And that we just weren't going to be accepted as brahmanas. You read about it in Prabhupada's books. But, you know, I distinctly remember, you know, having that impression. Therefore, they certainly didn't invite us to come and do a wedding for their daughters and sons. They would never ask us to be a priest for their, or to do a ceremony, or for us to do worship. They would get their priest to do it because we were just not considered to actually be the real things. But, and actually I remember when I started doing yajñas and ceremonies at people's homes, because before that, mostly, you know, people would come to the temple and do a ceremony. And I sort of, understanding that it would probably, we would have more people asking to do ceremonies if I made it really easy and just went to the homes. I didn't have enough to leave the home, you know, they could, and everything comes to them. People really like that. So, and I, you know, take the shalagram, what have you. But when I would go to the family's homes and knock on the door, I remember the first, you know, year or so, literally people looked at me and would say, oh, so the priest is in the car? Because they didn't expect this pinky to be, you know, they never thought in their wildest dreams that, you know, some Westerner would turn up on their doorstep to do the ceremony, and they're almost shocked, like, what do? Do we let him do it? You know? And, but what happened, again, you know, because whenever we do something as devotees, we speak something from the Gita, and they get the transcendental knowledge. And as they've got the transcendental knowledge, then they've understood, oh, this is the Gita, this is proper, and we really feel the presence of Krishna and appreciate Krishna more, and, you know, the understanding. And everyone, you know, all the children are joining in. Usually they're not interested, or, you know, all the people usually sit in the other room and watch cricket. They're all coming in, joining in, so they see that this is very attractive. There's something, you know, wonderful. So it actually, I never get that anymore, because the word of mouth, you know, people just, you know, the majority of the things I do is people say, you know, call, you know, get Gangeshwara, come and do your ceremony. But I remember those, you know, it was almost a little embarrassing, you know, they'd look at me and I'd have to, yes, I'm the priest. I don't get that much anymore. But in the early days, you know, it was a lot worse, very strong. It was almost, we were just never really going to be accepted. But, you know, as we would read these verses and we would say, well, look, this is their scriptures. This is word for word, and they've just got it wrong. The Hindu community's just got it wrong. You know, Prabhupada didn't invent something. You know, this is the right thing, and it makes sense. Why should someone, you know, by birth, why cannot, if they develop the qualities and come to that, why can they not, you know, perform the activities of a Brahmin or a, you know, as Prabhupada says, just because you're born in a family of, you know, lawyers, doesn't mean you can become qualified to law. Actually, Prabhupada says that, you know why they wear the Brahmin thread? Who knows why you wear the Brahmin thread? I'll tell you why. What's that? Tell you what Prabhupada says, that when you take birth in a Brahmana family, unless you are trained as a Brahmana to have the qualities, and then you show that you're capable, that you will be able to work, apply that knowledge in your life as a Brahmana, mind and sense is always controlled, always God conscious, and, you know, live, you know, the peaceful, then the guru awards the Brahmin thread. This, it's like a certificate. We, you know, you put up on the wall, yes, I've got, you know, a BA in such and such. It means that the guru considers this person has been trained. They're now an actual Brahmana. That's what the Brahmin thread is.
Like what we just said, back home, a lot of people learn by
Yeah. None of them been trained. But actually, you know, it properly means that the training is there. You know, at least it's understood that the person, you know, is open to the training and will go through more and more training. And so it can be given even earlier. You know, the promise is there. But, you know, these days what they do is, I'm Brahmana by birth, I'm getting married, I put the Brahmin thread on for the wedding, take it off after the wedding, that's what they do. You seen that? Have you, do you know? Some people do that. They say, oh, do you have Brahmin threads in the shop? I say, yeah. I'll go and buy one. Why is that? I've got to be a Brahmana during the wedding. I'm Brahmana by birth, that's what they do. So, you know that they do that? Okay, that's the strange thing about my service. I see all that, you know, it's really good because I get to see the things that people are doing wrong right down to the tiny little details, right in their own homes and everything. So, you know, Krishna gives me a bird's eye view of things that I didn't even know. I see them and I think, oh, you know, now I know what you Brahmanas get up to, eh? Right? And for 40 years, you've been making me feel like I don't have a place. Right? And all the while, this is what you've been doing. I see. So, but, you know, it's on the strength of Prabhupada's books that we know. No, we can challenge you. We'll stand up. Let's discuss this by Shastra. So, from Karandama came a son named Avikshit, and from Avikshit a son named Maruta, who was the emperor. So an emperor is like king of kings, right? The great mystic Samvata, the son of Angira, engaged Maruta in performing a sacrifice yajna. The sacrificial paraphernalia of King Maruta was extremely beautiful, for everything was made of gold. Indeed, no other sacrifice could compare to this. In that sacrifice, King Indra became intoxicated by drinking a large quantity of somarasa. The Brahmanas received ample contributions and therefore they were satisfied. For that sacrifice, the various demigods who control the winds offered foodstuffs, and the Vishvadevas were members of the assembly. Because of the yajna performed by Maruta, everyone was pleased. This is the purport. Especially the Brahmanas and Kshatriyas. Brahmanas are interested in receiving contributions as priests, and Kshatriyas are interested in drinking. All of them, therefore, were satisfied with their different engagements. Translation. Maruta's son was Dhamma. Dhamma's son was Rajvardhanam. Rajvardhana's son was Sudriti, and his son was Nara. The son of Nara was Kevala, and his son Dunduman, whose son was Vegavan, and Vegavan's son was Buddha, and Buddha's son was Trinabindu, who became the king of this earth. The best of the Apsaras, the highly qualified girl named Alambusha, accepted the similarly qualified Trinabindu as her husband. She gave birth to a few sons and a daughter known as Ilavila. After the great saint Vishrava, the master of mystic yoga, received absolute knowledge from his father, he begot in the womb of Ilavila the greatly celebrated son known as Kuvera, the giver of money. Trinabindu had three sons named Vishala, Sunyabandhu, and Dhumukritu. Among these three, Vishala created a dynasty and constructed a palace named Vaishali. The son of Vishala was known as Hemachandra. His son was Dhumaraksha, and his son was Samyama. His sons were Devaja and Krishasva. The son of Krishasva was Somadatta, who performed Ashwamedha sacrifices and thus satisfied the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu. By worshipping the Supreme Lord, he achieved the most exalted post, a residence on the planet to which great mystic yogis are elevated. The son of Somadatta was Sumati, whose son was Janamajaya. All these kings appearing in the dynasty of Vishala properly maintained the celebrated position of King Trinabindu. So these are personalities coming in the line from Vaibhishvata Manu. Let's see in our chart. Well, these charts are good because sometimes, you know, we will probably hear a little bit more about some of these personalities from time to time, and we can just very quickly look in here and see where they're situated in the family tree. So,
these people in the Vaivasvata Manu used to live 100 years, right?
Yeah, so people in Satyayuga live for 100,000 years. Those in Treta Yuga, 10,000 years. Was that 100,000 years in Satya? Treta. Yeah, 100,000 in Satya, 10,000 in Treta, and 1,000 in Dwapara, and 100 in Kali Yuga. Yeah.
So when they're living for 100,000 years, do you think with their sons when they're already 20,000 years older, or like we get our children
around the age of 20? Are they all from Satya Yuga? That whole line? I don't know. I'm not sure whether. It could be. I don't know. I'm not sure whether, you know, these dynasties, you know, were over some yugas or even divya yugas. I'm not sure. Because Manu lives for 71 cycles of the divya yugas. Well, he doesn't live that long. He reigns that long.
Question is,
I don't know. I've never read any Shastric reference. But what I do know is that they're not as limited as we are, which means that they can have children quite, you know, young, and they can have children even, you know, at advanced ages, because they're not as limited as we are. That's all I know. So it's quite possible that from, you know, quite range of their life, if the opportunity and the desire comes up to have children, maybe, you know, that they, you know, take another wife or something at a much later state or something. You see these sages. You know, some of these sages, you know, they take a wife at different times. Kings take a wife, you know, when they're young, and then they take another wife when they're older. So, you know, they're not as, their potency to have children is far greater than ours. You know, their ability to fulfill their desires is not as limited or, you know, wreaked with problems that we have.
And this Vyasatama and this dynasty, everybody has got about 2 to 10 children. They don't have 100,000 children or 60,000 children or something like that. But very few children, between 5 to 10.
Well, you know, if you've got one good child that can look after all your cows, you don't need 100 to look after the cows. You know, one good man. And
there's also the understanding that time scale is different over there.
Yeah.
One woman could be in so many years.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
so
that's
one calculation. It may be 10,000 there, but
yeah,
for them it might be just like 100 years for us.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a lot of considerations there.
So although they live 100,000 years, to them it appears only like 100 years.
Yeah. It's relative. They were still basically the problems of birth, death, old age, and disease are everywhere.
All the Brahman lives for so many trillions of years.
You can't escape it. For instance, a person who's very wealthy in this, you know, in this world, if you know, they, because they have knowledge, good education, they're less likely to suffer illness as those who are born into poverty and ignorance, because poverty and ignorance means that you're more likely to get ill, you're less likely to be able to cure it or get your medication. So there may be a higher standard, but when a wealthy person, you know, comes down, you know, breaks a leg, or a poor and ignorant fool breaks a leg, they'll both suffer the same. So whether you're in the higher planetary systems or on this earth, birth, death, old age, and disease are still a problem, as much as they are anywhere. But certainly, it is still a higher standard of life, but the same problem remains. In the same way, that the same problem remains for a wealthy person, even if they're a billionaire, considered to an ignorant. You know, it's the same problem. At old age, it doesn't matter whether you have, you know, in fact, old age for someone who's penniless, probably less painful than old age for someone who has billions of dollars that they're going to have to give up. So, you know, the problems of birth, death, old age, and disease are there. And they affect everyone. So, it's relative, but in another sense, it's the same situation. It's just chewing the chew. You know, at the end of Brahma's life, which is, what is it, 311 trillion years, 400 billion years, like that, he would be thinking just like us at the end of our 50, 60 years, we're thinking it just feels like a moment. And he'll be thinking the same thing. Oh, God, that went by quick. It's got over already? He'll be thinking the same as what we're thinking. So it's the same problem. Unless he's Krishna conscious. So, we're going to read chapter 3. The marriage of Sukanya and Chayavan Muni. Text number 1. Sri Sukadeva Goswami continued, O King, Sariyati, another son of Mandu, was the ruler, a ruler completely aware of Vedic knowledge. He gave instructions about the functions for the second day of the Yajna to be performed by the descendants of Angira. Sariyati had a beautiful lotus-eyed daughter named Sukanya, with whom he went to the forest to see the ashram of Chayavan Muni. While that Sukanya, surrounded by her friends, was collecting various types of fruits from the trees in the forest, she saw within the hole an earthworm, two things glowing like luminaries. As if induced by providence, the girl ignorantly pierced those two glowworms with a thorn, and when they were pierced, blood began to ooze out of them. Thereupon, all the soldiers of Sariyati were immediately obstructing from passing urine and stool. Upon perceiving this, Sariyati spoke to his associates in surprise. How strange it is that one of us has attempted to do something wrong to Chayavana Muni, the son of Bhrigu. It certainly appears that someone among us has polluted this ashram. Being very much afraid, the girl Sukanya said to her father, I have done something wrong, for I have ignorantly pierced these two luminous substances with a thorn. After hearing this statement by his daughter, King Sariyati was very much afraid. In various ways, he tried to appease Chayavan Muni, for it was he who sat within the hole of the earthworm. King Sariyati, being very contemplative and thus understanding Chayavan Muni's purpose, gave his daughter in charity to the sage. Thus released from danger with great difficulty, he took permission from Chayavan Muni and returned home. Purport. The king, after hearing the statement of his daughter, certainly told the great sage Chayavana Muni everything about how his daughter had ignorantly committed such an offence. The Muni, however, inquired from the king whether the daughter was married. In this way, the king, understanding the purpose of the great sage Chayavana Muni, immediately gave the Muni his daughter in charity and escaped the danger of being cursed. Thus, with the permission of the great sage, the king returned home. So here again you see Chayavana Muni, you know, these personalities are on a level with the demigods. And, you know, they live for long, long, long periods of time, and still he's marrying. So, you know, they have greater potency to fulfill their desires at any age. Chayavana Muni was very irritable, but since Sukanya had gotten him as her husband, she dealt with him carefully, according to his mood. Knowing his mind, she performed service to him without being bewildered. Report. This is the indication of the relationship between husband and wife. A great personality like Chayavana Muni has a temperament of always wanting to be in a superior position. Such a person cannot submit to anyone. Therefore, Chayavana Muni had an irritable temperament. His wife, Sukanya, could understand his attitude, and under the circumstances, she treated him accordingly. if any wife wants to be happy with her husband, she must try to understand her husband's temperament and please him. This is victory for a woman. Even in the dealings of Lord Krishna with his different queens, it has been seen that although the queens were the daughters of great kings, they placed themselves before Lord Krishna as his maidservants. However great a woman may be, she must place herself before her husband in this way, that is to say, she must be ready to carry out her husband's orders and please him in all circumstances, then her life will be successful. When the wife becomes as irritable as the husband, their life at home is sure to be disturbed or ultimately completely broken. In the modern day, the wife is never submissive, and therefore home life is broken even by slight incidents. Either the wife or the husband may take advantage of the divorce laws. According to the Vedic law, however, there is no such thing as divorce laws, and a woman must be trained to be submissive to the will of the husband. Westerners contend that this is a slave mentality for the wife, but factually it is not. It is the tactic by which a woman can conquer the heart of her husband, however irritable or cruel he may be. In this case, we clearly see that although Charvana Muni was not young, but indeed old enough to be Sukanya's grandfather, and was also very irritable, Sukanya, the beautiful young daughter of a king, submitted herself to the old husband and tried to please him in all respects. Thus she was a faithful and chaste wife. So, this Charvana Muni was old enough to be a grandfather. Possibly a great-grandfather. Any comments? Or the men, or the ladies?
They say this, but because they say Bhagavatam is applicable in every time and in all circumstances. Now, this statement I'm telling about a woman, how is it applicable now? Because what I've heard is that, in fact, there have heard situations where they've said that if your partner is favorable for Krishna consciousness to stay. If that's not there, it's not leave. We find even in our devotee association, we find Mataji is having to leave the husband because the child is, in fact, they fear for the child. And the child is also being abused or ill-treated.
What it says is that Prabhupada says, if any wife wants to be happy with her husband, she must try to understand her husband's temperament and please him. This is victory for a woman. Right? So this means that victory means that she's not in the inferior position in the marriage, but the superior position of control. Victory means you're the controller. Anyone who has victory means that they're now controlling the situation. They have that ability to exert the influence of control, not always just being controlled. So that's victory, the victor. And Westerners contend that this is a slave mentality for the wife, but factually it is not. It is the tactic by which a woman can conquer the heart of her husband, however irritable or cruel he may be. Right? So, therefore, if a woman is able to control the heart of her husband, then she can, you know, that if her will is that, you know, although the husband has a cruel side and an irritable side, that no, disturbing. There are no disturbances for the children because that is the will of the wife, and the husband abides by that because she has controlled his heart. You see, so therefore, there is no cruelty to the children. There is no abuse of the wife. There is no activities which bring ill repute to the family, because the wife actually has control of the husband. Despite the nature of the husband, maybe to be a bit cruel, irritable, you know, like this, that if she's against that because she has control of it, it doesn't happen. So therefore, the marriage is successful, despite. See? Now, if the person is heartless, that, you know, sociopath, psychopath, you know, no one enters their heart at all, not their wife, not their children, not anyone in society. They have no sin. Then that is a different thing. Then the wife definitely should leave, you see, because, you know, the thing here is that the person has to have a heart. You know, now some men, they just, their heart is you know, like coal, and it's as cold as, it's just, there is nothing to work with. In that case, they should leave. Definitely. And you know, if that proves to be the case, there is nothing to work with. There's not a heart to work with. This person is heartless. You know, they cannot empathize with others' happiness and success. That doesn't register in their heart. Then that is a waste of time. Then both the wife and the children are in danger, and they should leave.
But I think mommy's question was also, what if the husband is against the wife being Krishna conscious?
Well, again, you know, that you know,
I can answer that. Can I just say that something to?
No, go on.
So long as a husband may be against Krishna consciousness, but suppose he is a caring person, he cares for his children and the saints, due to some reason he's against.
Yeah.
So I think it is good for the wife to adjust, just give him prasadam and continue with it. Maybe not tell him that, okay, I'm giving prasadam, whatever.
Yeah.
And try to get him over.
Because he loves because he loves his wife and children, he's against it, but he lets them do it and doesn't cause disturbance to them.
Yeah, so there will be a turning point. I think this has come up in some situations.
Well, Prabhupada's sister's husband was like that. And he eventually, at the end, became a devotee after a lifetime. No, they don't stop because they do have a heart where they actually, which the woman, you know, the wife and the children, they're definitely in the man's heart, and they have control, because the person does actually, you know, have strong feelings for them. And although they're against something, they just, no, I'm not going to act on that because, you know, there's a person like that. So then, over the course of time, it's possible that person, you know, can become Krishna conscious. But if the person doesn't even, they're against Krishna consciousness, and they really don't, within the heart, they actually have no emotional attachment to the wife and children. There's nothing to work with. That's a problem. That's a major problem. You know, there has to be significant. I was going to say that myself. You sometimes see that, you know. You sometimes see where, you know, it could be the wife, it could be the husband. They're actually Krishna conscious, but they don't seem to have their heart is like, you know, the ice queen or the ice king sort of thing for the partner and the children.
So is that a dangerous one? So that's a more dangerous situation, you're saying?
No, because you can actually work on a platform. The Krishna consciousness means, you know, let's again, we were talking about this at the beginning of the class. Krishna consciousness, does that mean they've done Bhakti Shastri, you know, Bhakti Vaibhava, the chanting 16 rounds, they've got initiated and they're doing a regular service? They call that Krishna consciousness? Mm-hmm. That's not Krishna consciousness. We said here in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, there are all sorts of a person who doesn't act for their own sense gratification, but always for the interests of Krishna. Oh, here's my wife, my children. They're trying to be Krishna conscious. I'm Krishna's devotee. I'm going to assist them to become Krishna conscious, to please Krishna, to 100%. That's Krishna conscious. Now, if someone's claiming, I'm Krishna conscious, here's my wife and children want to be Krishna conscious, and I'm giving them hell so much that they don't want to be devotees anymore. What sort of Krishna consciousness is that? How pleasing is that to Krishna? What is that Krishna consciousness? See, this is the thing, that people are basing Krishna consciousness on so many external things. It's actually become a major problem that we see in ISKCON, because you can actually be in ISKCON now for many, many years with all sorts of certification and position and all sorts of things, and not actually even have a trace of the qualities Krishna mentions in the Gita as to what someone is who's Krishna conscious and transcendentally situated, and no one seems to care. and that's the new Krishna consciousness. Not only do they not care, no one notices, because they're not Krishna conscious enough to notice. Or they're too infatuated with, you know, their own, you know, whatever. Position, goals, you know, for spreading the name and fame all over Facebook and all over the world, whatever. They don't even notice. So if a person is Krishna conscious, they're not going to be a problem to other people, generally. If they're actually Krishna conscious, they're not going to give trouble to, you know, their husband or wife who are trying to be devotees. Otherwise, you really got to question, what sort of Krishna is that? Krishna consciousness? Is it possible a person be Krishna conscious and be so obstructive to their own family who are trying to be devotees? What sort of Krishna that is? Just, it's a contradiction. You know, I can't even get my head around that. I would never consider that Krishna consciousness. I can't fathom that someone could say, yes, that's Krishna consciousness. That Krishna would like the wife and the children trying to be devotees, and the person who's supposed to be the most Krishna conscious person in their life is destroying their life, you know, obstructing it every step, giving them grief. And somehow or another, Krishna would be very displeased with it. So what is it? You know, as Prabhupada explains, it's this type of Krishna consciousness, that you massage Krishna's feet. Oh, I've cooked for you, you know, hundreds of gulab jamuns, you know, worship the deities, I gave class, I've massaged your lotus feet. Now that I'm finished, Krishna, I slap your face. And tomorrow, you can get a little bit more of that. I'll come back, massage your feet, slap your face. So Prabhupada goes, what sort of Krishna consciousness is that? That I, you know, I do all this nice service, and here are these, your husband and wife, the wife and the children, and, you know, these are right, your dear devotees, Krishna, yeah? Okay, slap, slap, slap them around, give them trouble. You like that? That's slapping Krishna's face. You know, that's that level of Krishna consciousness. That's not proper Krishna consciousness. Actually, the definition of Krishna consciousness is it must be favorable to Krishna. Otherwise, it's the Kamsa type of Krishna consciousness is mixed in with it.
I've heard stories of...
If we're jealous of another person, and that person is our husband, or, you know, our children, our wife, and we're jealous of that person, Prabhupada says jealousy begins with that jealousy of Krishna, and therefore it flows from there. If we're jealous of anyone, it's because we still have jealousy for Krishna. So, you know, what is that? You know, there's some Krishna consciousness there, but it's the massage of Krishna's feet, slap his face type of Krishna consciousness. We don't want a movement full of that sort of, especially if there's more slapping and less massaging. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, I met a devotee a long time ago, and she actually explained that both her parents were in Krishna consciousness together, but her father was a type of devotee who took, who was always putting down his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And he took the statements from Prabhupada's books to put her down even more.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of that.
And she said that her mother could take it, so she continued to be Krishna consciousness, but she left him. And yeah. Then all her father would say is that you're not a chaste person.
Mm-hmm.
You're not a chaste woman. That's not according to Prabhupada's books.
Mm-hmm.
So he just continued to put her down.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, there's. I've seen a lot of that. In the early days, that sort of behaviour was rampant amongst devotees, you know, family members. Very bad dealings, abusive. You know. In the name of, you know, oh, but they're Krishna, they're nice. But they're a nice devotee. It makes my stomach churn when I hear that. People do these terrible things, you know, to other devotees, families or friends, and then people turn, oh, but they're a nice devotee. They're doing so much nice service. Every time I hear that, even now, my stomach churns. I can feel it just, you know, it makes my blood boil. We don't want a movement where we're all like that. That, oh, yes, I'm a nice devotee, therefore, you know, that's why I'm getting away with murder. We don't want to, you know, we want to be like Jesus, you know, like Prabhupada, like the Acharyas. You know, we're scared to call ourselves a devotee, a Vaishnava, because Vaishnava is like, you know... Someone asked Prabhupada, he was in Bombay, at the end of a lecture, forget his question, that, you know, he was saying, We should always try to remember Krishna is God. And Prabhupada says, yes, so why are you forgetting God? And then he said something like, what happens if a Vaishnava falls down? And Prabhupada said, a Vaishnava doesn't fall down. So, there was one devotee who was Prabhupada's disciple. And, his disciples would, Prabhupada would allow them to sort of play and challenge. Prabhupada would sometimes take the role of the atheist or the materialist or the scientist, and they would have to defeat his argument. He was given the Maya argument, and they would have to try and defeat him. And one of his disciples said, Prabhupada is Vaishnavas. Vaishnava? You are not Vaishnava. You'll fall down at the drop of a hat. So, generally we should be, very hesitant to call ourselves, a nice devotee. Nice devotees are very, very elevated people. We use the term very lightly. We're the humble servant, aspiring devotees like that. But so many of these people who have resting upon their laurels that they have created the image that I am a big, nice devotee, and therefore they're doing all sorts of, un-Vaishnav things. Then they're not a big Vaishnav, because Vaishnavs don't do that sort of thing. So, it comes down to many things we're reading today. We see that the actual qualities on the spiritual platform is what counts. The proof is in the pudding. You can actually test, we can test ourselves as a devotee, and we can test other devotees. We can see there's a test. To the degree that we act according to our own, what satisfies our mind and senses, or to the degree that we act to satisfy Krishna's sense. That is the test. Very simple. We know that Krishna, the first offence is to commit Vaishnava aparad, that if someone's trying to be a devotee and we cause them any type of disturbance, in that Harinam Chintamani, Haridas the course says, if a person, who's trying to be a devotee, if they walk past a Vaishnava and do not show their pleasure, they create an offence. Sometimes people think, I'm jealous of this person. I'm not going to do anything to them. But when they walk past, you can see that there's no pleasure that they've seen you that day. Even you may not have seen them for a long time. That person is created. They call it Harinam Chintan. That person is created Vaishnava. Right. What to speak of daily harassing children and a wife on a daily basis, criticizing, putting them down, making them feel bad, sad, crying on a regular basis. And where does that fit in? So, and of course, this is why we study these books, because on the basis of these books, we want Vaishnavas who are following the guidelines of Prabhupada's books, not that we have a new standard of Vaishnava or Vaishnavi, where they don't tally with anything that's in the Gita or the Srimad Bhagavatam, but somehow everyone's saying, oh, they're a really nice devotee. But whatever we see in the Bhagavatam as nice qualities, we don't see much of that in their person. That's not the sort of movement we want. And that's why, we have to study these books. They're very, very important. It is the books that is protecting the purity of this movement. To the degree that we just don't take proper notice or pay lip service to this book, the purity of the movement just erodes within, immediately. And to the degree that we try and mould our life and help Vaishnavas and Vaishnavis develop the qualities. Now, to that degree, the purity of the movement is there. And it is the purity of the movement where the potency that Krishna acts through that purity. When Krishna sees that pure-hearted, that we're acting, really trying to please Krishna, Krishna empowers those devotees, that movement like that. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur used to say, please, my request is, do not try to just imitate the activities and the dress of a Vaishnava, but please try to assimilate the consciousness, the thoughts of a Vaishnava. To be a nice Vaishnava, therefore, Srila is saying that our heart has to be similar to a Vaishnava's heart. If our heart is like Kamsa, and externally our activities are like a Vaishnava, he's saying, please don't do that. So, any other questions or comments?
But how come, like, if chanting should have an effect, wouldn't you expect chanting to soften their heart?
I was explaining that in the beginning of the class. I'm not sure if you were here. That association, which we see a lot of, because ISKCON now, as I said previously, when you came to ISKCON, you know, if you wanted social life, you know, society, friendship and love, don't go to ISKCON because it didn't exist. You know, you came here to work like a dog for Krishna without any reward, without any remuneration, any respect, and it was very hard and difficult, you know, but blissful because you're working for Krishna. Nowadays, 90% of the people can come to this movement and never have to experience any difficulties at all, that and just enjoy a wonderful life of socializing and feasting and festivals and, you know, dressing up and, you know, in nice silks and, you know, prancing around like, you know, advanced Vaishnavas and Vaishnavis with all their fancy clothes and so many things like that. So, when devotees associate, previously the association was not to satisfy our desires for socializing and things. When we associated with a Vaishnava or a Vaishnavi, we wanted to hear and chant in their association. You know, we wanted to and serve in their association. Now, that part of it is watered down a lot, and a lot of it is so our chanting, I mean, I see when it comes to chanting, you know, a lot of devotees chant while they're socializing. You know, it's you wander around the courtyard with your bead bags, yeah, nice kids have your lunch, kissing. You go into the rough thing, like your chatter. That's actually a norm. You see that now it's a norm. If anyone previously did that, they wouldn't dare. Seriously, you wouldn't dare do something. You know, now it's a norm. You know, when I was a teenager, I went to visit my girlfriend actually in Tasmania. And her mother, who used to smoke cigarettes, so we were going down to the town. We're going down to the town. Yeah, a small town in Tasmania. This is back in 1970s. And she lit up a cigarette in the car, and she'd only taken a couple of puffs, and then when she got out of the car, she stamped it out. I said, what did you do that for? You just lit it up. She said, I wouldn't be seen dead in public smoking a cigarette. And I thought, oh, you see. So still in those days, for a woman, you know, it was unladylike. It was, okay, I smoked, but not in public. You know, it's like, it's embarrassing. You know, it's a dirty habit sort of thing. Then as time goes by, what they do in the streets now doesn't do anything. You see, that is gone. So similarly, in ISKCON previously, you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't just sit around the courtyard shooting the breeze and chanting. You'd be embarrassed. You just wouldn't do it. Now, it's common. So you ask the question, why is it we can be chanting, associating, and it seems like, you know, people are not making... It's because the association is, you know, has to be proper, you know, based upon associating with devotees in a very Krishna-conscious way. You know, like that. That every interaction with the devotee, every single interaction with the devotee is another opportunity. It doesn't mean that the social aspect is there. That's just automatic, a secondary thing. The way a devotee does things is that they're interested in Krishna, but Krishna's interested in his devotees. So a devotee is just thinking of service, but Krishna's thinking, I'm so happy with my devotee, I want to make their nice life. So automatically the social fulfillment is there. You know, everything that one may be searching after in material life, that is there automatically by Krishna's pleasure. So for instance, you know, a devotee doesn't necessarily live to eat. They live to offer food to Krishna. But Krishna is so kind to his devotees that devotees eat better than anyone in this world. But they're not chasing that. They want to feed Krishna. So it's not as if, you know, ISKCON should be devoid of socializing. Not that. Those things are automatic by the grace of Krishna to a degree that no one else in this world. You look at the Pandavas, you know, their level of the wonderful full life with everything, all the bells and whistles are all there, but they didn't search after it. They just searched after Krishna's friendship. Now, they put Krishna aside, even devotees, you know, chanting their rounds. Let's just, you know, yeah, it's there, but I'm really more interested in this social interaction. Krishna, you know. So it's a different thing. But, you know, that's, if we study the books, then we understand what is the real thing. What is the real Vaishnava? What is the real Vaishnavi? And we try to have that consciousness within the heart, the change of heart. By that knowledge, therefore, that verse that we read, I've read several times, chapter 23, fourth chapter, verse 23 of the Bhagavad Gita. Gadasangasya muktasya gyanavasi tachetisa yagya charitra kama samagram pravaliyate. The work of a man who is unattached to the modes of material nature, so they're not seeking that, who is fully situated in transcendental knowledge, merges entirely into transcendence. By studying Prabhupada's books, we actually get the transcendental understanding of how we act and what our motivation should be in Krishna consciousness. And if we actually follow that, then we become to the spiritual platform. And if people associate with such a devotee, they'll also come to the spiritual platform. That transcendental knowledge, that comes from Prabhupada's books, and that maintains the purity, the spiritual purity of each and every individual and the movement as a whole. Otherwise, it doesn't merge into transcendence. It actually merges into the modes of material nature. Anyway, so, we've gone over time, 10 minutes. You're going to hurt my neck for that. So we'll leave it there. And we'll continue with this story. Not a big chapter, so there's 36 verses, and we'll finish that very quickly next week, and then we'll be moving in to chapter 4, Ambarish Maharaj. So that's a nice story there. So we're going to get through this ninth canto this year. That's my goal, my ambition, and then at the end of the year, I'll hand you all your study things, which you can do over the holidays. You know, what to study, the verses, you know, a rough idea of what we're going to do in the question exams and the essays. I'll give you all of that. You can study it over the holidays, and we'll come back and do something. So for this year, we'll just finish this canto. You'll start do all your study notes over the holidays. We'll come back to them, and we'll do 10th canto. That's a plan. All right, thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.